Gary Sassman, Director of Public Relations for Comic-Con. I'd like to welcome you all to the spotlight of the UK. I've been a fan of this guy's work since the very first Buddy Bradley stories, which were how many years ago?
100 million years ago.
100 million years ago, they were actually etched in stone. And he's since gone on to do great graphic novels for Vertigo and Dark Horse, and of course, again, for Fantagraphics. I'm also here today to honor Peter with Comic-Con's Inkpot Award for Achievement in Comic Arts.
Oh, yeah! Well, surprise, surprise. There we go.
Oh, great. Okay, can everybody hear us okay?
Hold it up.
Oh, yeah, show it off.
Enough with the award. All right.
Oh, wait.
You want a picture of the Wordle by itself?
I did a nice likeness of you.
There you go.
My name is Jason T. Miles, and I'm going to be the moderator for this. And I'm going to run a brief biography, have a couple questions for Pete, and then we're going to open it up for your questions. We've got an hour, so we'll try to fit a lot in if we can. Pete Bagg was born and raised in Peekskill, New York. He attended SVA, where he discovered the work of Robert Crumb and other underground cartoonists. Appropriately, he dropped out to work on the last issue of Punk. Is that right?
Would have been the last issue of Punk. They went out of business before my work appeared in it.
Okay.
There was a special edition Punk magazine. Very complicated. There's a very... What would have been the last issue of Punk came out a couple years later, and it was tied to a punk rock documentary, something, and I had some comics in there.
That was Punk was founded in 1974 by John Holstrom, who Peter later worked with on Comical Funnies as well as Stop. While self-publishing and producing Comical Funnies and Stop, Pete would send his work to Crumb, who took a shine to it, would publish Pete in Weirdo, and eventually pass the reins off of editorial for 8 issues to Pete. While during that time, he started his Neat Stuff comic, which was published by Fantagraphics, after which he did Hate, which he continues to do today as Hate Annual. He's done a myriad of other projects since then. Yeah, Sweatshop. He's done Spider-Man, The Incredible Hulk, Bat Boy for the World Weekly News. He's done comics for Reason Magazine, which have recently been collected in Everybody is Stupid Except for Me and Other Astute Observations. He did the...
An Eisner loser.
An Eisner loser, by the way.
But I got this, which is prettier. And
he's also, this year, released Other Lives on Vertigo. His first comic was officially published in 1980. He's got a 30-year career, and we have less than an hour. So we'll try to cover what we can. Is there anything you want to say first, or?
It sounds like I know Jason. He works for Fantagraphics, so I know him pretty well. He lives in my hometown, and I'm very flattered to see that Jason is particularly interested in not just my work, but a lot of other underground comic work that came out in the 80s, which I assume you're going to ask me about or that we talk about, because that seems so forgotten, not just a Weirdo magazine itself, which was an anthology that ran all through the 80s, but there are all these other mini-comics from the time and comic books that even Fantagraphics published that are now very obscure.
Mm-hmm.
Forgetting the names. I was about to say a bunch of names and titles, and I can't remember any of them, but you'll probably remember them. So I like the idea of talking about that stuff for that very reason that it's been so forgotten.
Right.
That being said, talk about any old thing.
Yeah, I think I'd like to try to cover the early stuff and some of the more recent stuff. Basically, what I'm curious about is, what was it while you're at SVA? Were you studying fine arts at all, or illustration?
When you were a freshman, they had, I don't know what they call it now. I went to SVA for three semesters back in 1977. And back then when you were a freshman, they had a program called Foundations, and you had to take a little of everything. And it's a bit of a scam, because they know that a lot of people, like I knew quite a few students there, freshmen, who knew not only that they wanted to be comic artists, they wanted to draw superheroes. So it was a way to, so otherwise they would have just taken a small handful of cartooning classes and then dropped out. So they were always devising ways to keep people to stay, stick out the whole 4 years. So as a freshman, even if you had zero interest in photography, you had to take a photography class, a painting class, a drawing class, and I forget what else, art history, there was something else, sculpture. And especially photography was a real bitch, mainly because I had like no money. I had to work for a year and a half to pay for a year and a half of college, and meanwhile support myself while I was going to school. I had no money, didn't have shoes. I had shoes that were, I once applied for a job and got fired because my shoes were so disgusting. They were, so I was like, well, how can I buy new shoes if you won't give me a job? And so here I am, a freshman at SVA, and in the photography class, they said, you need a camera, but not just any camera. It's got to be, you know, 35 millimeter. It was like a minute. This is like $1977 dollars, minimum $300 camera. And I was like, you fuckers. Like, Jesus, what a fucking scam. Give me one. You know, what the hell? So, yeah, I couldn't quit fast enough. In my second year, I tried. Again, I can't believe that I went along with this. When my second year started, that's all they wanted to do was to take their cartooning classes. And back then, they only had, during the day, they only had three regular cartoon teachers. They were good. Well, it was an amazing lineup. It was Art Spiegelman, Harvey Kurtzman, and Will Eisner. And I wanted to take their classes and maybe another drawing class and then quit. But the guidance counselor knew exactly what my game was. And she says, no, no, no. Somehow she managed to talk me into not taking any cartooning classes. There I was stuck in a bunch of garbage that I couldn't stand, and I was failing all the classes, so I quit. And then I took, I actually took one excellent night course there. I don't know if anybody remembers this guy, but he used to do gag comics for mainly the National Lampoon, and his name was Sam Gross. And his comics lived up to its name. Well, you would know. His most famous cartoon was people in a French restaurant, and there was a sign that says, special tonight, frog's legs.
Yes.
And then a frog came out with no legs on a dolly. His comics were the most disgusting things ever. And he was a fantastic teacher. And then I also, whenever I could during the day, I used to, specifically, I would sit in on Art Spiegelman's classes, simply because they were very informative. You know, he was a human encyclopedia, and he was very passionate. Back then, I mean, as he's like that, I suppose, still, back then, he was very much this way. He had a real my way or the highway attitude about comics, you know. Mm-hmm. You either agreed with absolutely everything that I believe is good and bad in comics, or you're an idiot. So he could be, since I disagreed with him a lot, that was a problem.
Well, I'm curious about that. During the 80s, when you were editing Weirdo, there was what was perceived to be a rivalry between Raw, which was edited by Art Spiegelman and his wife, Françoise Mouly, and Weirdo, which, I mean, the sensibilities were different, similar, there was some crossover, but...
Well, yes.
Did you feel a sense of competition, or was there...
Well, yeah, but it wasn't... It was never... it wasn't deliberate, and it wasn't something that we played up. You know, I suppose we could have, but... at root... the differences, there weren't any differences. At root, it was basically the idea of using comics as a form of self-expression in whatever way that would take, you know. So we were both looking for artwork by anybody who was passionate about what they were doing and was unique. It was not something you see every day. But that being said, Art Spiegelman and his wife, Françoise Mouly, they had a second agenda, which was to elevate comics as an accepted form of art. And they lived in New York, and they were either always have or were starting to move in higher circles. Art still had a day job. Art Spiegelman still had a day job at Tops, which was pretty lowbrow. And he used to tell everybody, he used to tell me not to tell anyone he works at Tops, even though it was common knowledge. He just didn't want the Art Spiegelman of Raw Magazine to be associated with the Art Spiegelman of Tops. He later changed that. You know, after a while, he stopped being embarrassed of Tops, but... but back then that was like part of his agenda, was he wanted it to be thought of as a fine art. You know, he lived right in the, I suppose he still does, lived right in the middle of Soho, which was rapidly becoming like the fine art center of the universe. And it showed not just in the work, like, so even though he would look for people who were telling personal stories or had their own unique worldview, but he liked artists who were also at the same time had a fine art sensibility. And also the presentation of the book, if I don't know if everybody here remembers Raw or knows what Raw is, it was very elaborate, very beautifully, their production standards couldn't be higher. You know, they would, Francois would sit there at the printer and pick over every little thing. Now, Robert Crumb, around the same time, started Weirdo. And again, keeping in mind those shared sensibilities that he had with art. And Robert Crumb and Art Spiegelman, they've known each other for years, you know, at least a dozen years, and they both came up in the underground comics world. But, and I don't know if Raw fit into this or pushed him, it might have, but what Crumb tried to do with Weirdo is to keep it all very lowbrow, to wallow in the lowbrow. So even though you still were looking for people using comic art as a form of self-expression, he liked it to be, look like ephemera, you know, look like stuff. He would like literally publish stuff he found in the gutter or on a telephone pole. And he wasn't particularly, other than everything being legible, neither he or I were very persnickety about the look. It still was a roughly a traditional underground comic book, you know, black and white art printed on cheap newsprint. So, but the thing was, quickly over time, I'm sorry if I'm...
No, go.
Around this time, too, underground comics, at least as far as being economically viable, were dead. There still were... I think there were three publishers still in business from underground comics heyday in the late 60s and 70s, but the only comics that really made money were anything by Robert Crumb or Bill Griffith, who did Zippy, or the Freak Brothers by Gilbert Shelton. And other than that, unless it was like very pornographic or really pandered to potheads or something, it just didn't make any money. So, and now you have this whole generation of cartoonists, including myself, who are inspired by underground comics, and we all wanted to do comics in our own style and in our own format. So by the early 80s, you had almost everybody self-publishing, including Spiegelman and Francois. They were always self-published. So there suddenly was, with the profusion of Kinko's, all over the country, people were putting out their own little mini-comics, and me and my friends started self-publishing a tabloid. Me and Holmstrom and some other guys published Comical Funnies, which is in a tabloid format. And everybody was experimenting with formats, and at that time, all around the same time, when I started self-publishing, Matt Groening was self-publishing, Linda Barry was self-publishing, Charles Burns was self-publishing, Gary Panter was self-publishing, later on, Chester Brown and all those Canadian cartoonists, and a lot of them, it was just Kinko's. It was just cheap little mini-comics, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. And what was interesting, too, about that time, and I think it's because nobody had any... You were crazy if you thought at that time if you were going to make a living or make much of a profit off of your comic books. People were very true to their impulse. And so not just the formats they were working in, but the styles, their art styles, and the stories they were telling, they were all radically different. Like, even though they were friends, to this day they are, and they even collaborated sometimes, nobody would confuse Gary Panter's artwork with Charles Burns. And again, even though they were best friends, nobody would confuse Matt Groening's artwork with Linda Barry's. And on and on and on. Everybody had this very different, very radically different drawing style. And when I first saw work by Chester Brown, I'd never seen anything like it. Now, I'll sound like a grumpy old man, but shortly after that, by the 90s, it seemed like there were 5,000 Chester Browns. but back then, everybody's drawing style was so different. And what happened with Weirdo and Raw was we both started drawing from the same talent pool. So by the end of Weirdo's run, and by the end of Raw's run, first of all, Raw became less visually oriented and became more story oriented. And that is especially true when they changed the format. It used to be really big. It was like an art gallery on paper. And then I think they started co-publishing with Pantheon.
Penguin.
Penguin. And then it was suddenly digest-sized. And then all of a sudden there was much more of an emphasis on storytelling, although the art in it was still beautiful. But both Raw and Weirdo, we both published Panther, we both published Linda Barrowry, we both...
Justin Green.
And then especially Kaz, a cartoonist named Kaz, who does the Underworld comic strip, and Drew Friedman. And Drew Friedman used to collaborate a lot with his brother Josh. Those two guys were in every issue of both publications at some point. And then Robert Crumb himself was also, he would be in Weirdo, and he'd also be in Raw magazine.
One question I had, well, first of all, with Weirdo, what seems to go back and look at those issues, one of the things that strikes me is the opening spreads, where you'd have the letters and all the nut job rants, you know, people writing in saying you're an idiot or you're wonderful, and then you would have the plugs page. And to look back at Weirdo, it's like a roster of all the talent that would rise to the top in the 90s. You know, you'd have Chester Brown's, like you said, sending in stuff. At the time, did you feel a sense of duty, or was it just that there was such a lack of interesting work or interesting idiosyncratic work coming out, and that's why you were doing that? Because, I mean, today, if you look at, I mean, graphic novel, there's no room for, hey, you should check out this
plug. Well, you can make room.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, the plugs page or the letters page, all that stuff's going away.
Right.
I mean, what are your thoughts on that as far as that community that was once there?
Well, I was very eager to do that. Not only did I do it in Weirdo, but I always did it in Hate.
Yeah.
And before that in Neat Stuff, is people would send me work, whether it was a comic book, a little self-published comic book, or a fanzine. Back then, fanzines have been completely replaced by blogs, mm-hmm. which are cheaper and can be easily read by more people. You don't have to send money and, you know, deal with the post office. But I was very excited about this stuff that people were sending me. You know, if I plugged it, I really liked it. You know, there was an awful lot of stuff I didn't plug. There was most of it I didn't like enough to mention.
Do people send you stuff today?
Every now and then, yeah. But usually they'll just send me a link to their website. Occasionally they'll send me a mini comic. It's odd, the mini comics, that, with very rare exceptions, the mini comics that people send me now are routinely terrible. They're just garbage. You know, I always assume that it's by a high school kid, and lots of times it isn't. But, except I see, you know, of course, you walk around the Fantagraphics table and the Joint Quarterly table and the Top Shelf table, and I'll see artists I've never heard of before, and the work is brilliant. I wish they would send me their work.
So that kind of goes into a question I had regarding, you know, Weirdo always, and during the 80s there was Weirdo, Robert Williams was starting up Juxtapose towards the end of it, and there was this real, planting this flag of ugly art, lowbrow art. Weirdo had the once infamous ugly art contest. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts today on, you know, where you've seen that gone from the lowbrow to the present day? Because it seems to me that the distinction between what was once highbrow, once lowbrow, particularly via the efforts of Crumb, yourself, Art Spiegelman, that playing field's a lot more slippery than it once was.
Right. Well,
I mean, are you more inclined to go into an art gallery now, or are you...
Well, there's still art galleries that, there's still different sensibilities, and galleries pander to different groups of people. So there's, like, for example, there's a gallery that's been around for quite a while in Seattle called Rock LaRue. And what they show is completely in line with what you'd see in Juxtapose magazine. You know, it'd be Mark Ryden and Robert Williams and Charlie Kraft and Lisa Petrucci. You know, yeah, the lowbrow, mm-hmm. you know, deliberate lowbrow stuff. Outsider art. I hate that term, but mm-hmm. a lot of those guys love it. Joe Coleman loves that term. Joe Coleman always tells me, every time I meet him, he says, I'm an outsider artist. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I know. And then he'll start to explain to me what that means.
do you still feel outside of all of that?
Me? Yeah. Well, let me back up a bit. Again, from where I'm coming from, and when we were talking about these magazines, that Raw and Weirdo, and what we were up against, And what's again, that's something that used to, me and my closest cartoonist friends in New York, something that used to irk us about Spiegelman, used to annoy us, was that he was trying to pander to the fine art crowd and fine art sensibilities to the point of he seemed like to be co-opting them, co-opting their language, so almost, and it, not to sound cruel, but almost selling out to them, mm-hmm. which drove us crazy because I hated everything about them. I hated the fine art world because I don't know if you remember that what's qualified for fine art is if you had any draftsmanship, the fine art world hated you. If you could draw a tree that looked like a tree, you weren't a fine artist. You were an illustrator, and being called an illustrator was to them was the biggest insult. And this sensibility completely and utterly dominated every art school in New York. It was the days of installation art, piles of sand in a corner, strings being strung from wall to wall. Utter horseshit. It was just, and you had to keep a straight face if your intro there. And you know, and like the million, you know, so many people ripping off Rothko, but the artist would pretend he didn't. If you mentioned Rothko's name, he'd be like, "What are you talking about?" You know, we were like three blotches of color. You know, and you know, to me, Rothko was a chump. You know, and but here, like, this guy, you know, like fellow art students, or when you go into a gallery, I'm like, this is like a 10th generation Rothko ripoff. But the artist would never own up to that. The gallery owner would never. They'd be like, what are you talking about? This guy invented something completely new. And everybody would be standing around and be really serious about the whole thing. You know, there were a small handful of artists that. What was strange was. The one glaring exception to that, again, I'm getting a bit off field here, but the one glaring exception back then were painters who painted uber realistically. There was a simultaneous, and I think it was a reaction to that, but you'd see their work in the same galleries who, there was this hyper-realism or photorealistic paintings. And it tended to be a real straight guy thing. I don't know, there's something about straight guys where they're always trying to, they're obsessed with composition and... the word's escaping me, you know, trying to make your 2D drawing look perspective, yes. And so that was like the straight guy's little domain. And I don't know if you ever heard of Chuck Close.
Oh, yeah.
Or Dwayne Hansen, who did those. And I actually liked their work, but there were a lot of people doing stuff like that that weren't nearly as brilliant as those guys. So something like Big Daddy Roth. It's like nobody would admit to liking Big Daddy Roth. And anybody who went to any kind of art school was trained to hate that. That was, for every reason, it's ugly, it's anti-intellectual, you know, and even Big Daddy Roth fans choose to forget is, as years went by, he himself began to react against the prevailing... hippie ethos, even though he was originally part of the counterculture and had a lot of the, in the early and mid 60s, had a lot of the underground cartoonists working for him, most notably Robert Williams. Mm-hmm. He did not share their politics. And if you look at Hot Rod magazines in the late 60s, he used to always be those big monster guys, you know, that was his motif, was the monster guy grinning and holding onto the gigantic stick shift, and it would say Mother's Worry or something like that. After a while, it quickly became American soldiers in tanks with, like, the remains of a Viet Cong dangling from his mouth, you know, with the Asian rice picker hat on, you know, and the buck teeth, really racist stuff, and it would say, the Viet Cong for lunch bunch. And I would be like, I'd have such mixed reactions. I'd be like, what an asshole this guy must be. But his drawings are fantastic. I would still try to copy them. So I think that has something that is... So it became associated with... Like, lowbrow became associated with... if you were a sensitive, well-educated, liberal type who lived on either coast, you would associate... You couldn't help but associate Big Daddy Roth art with guys who beat you up, so accurately. Right. So there was this natural reaction to it. But I began obviously imitating him and imitating Basil Wolverton, mm-hmm. and Basil Wolverton, someone else that, you know, was just the epitome of horrible, disgusting, terrible art. If you're an art school graduate in New York City, it's just, it's not art, it's crap. And that's the other thing, too, when I was in high school, and I'd even get a lot of this in, even in SVA, which was started by cartoonists, even a lot of my fine art teachers, they said comic art isn't art. In no way, shape, or form is that art. And that's what I was always told. So, I understood Spiegelman. Well, I had mixed feelings about it. I understood Spiegelman, for obvious pragmatic reasons, wanted it to be recognized as an art form. You know, because then you get published by Pantheon, and then you get invited by universities to throw a lot of money to flap your jaw at their school. Am I right?
Well, it should be noted, too, that recently a blue chip gallery in Chelsea just had a giant Basil Wolverton retrospective, and a lot's changed.
I was going to say, there was the other thing is, I liked that it was, I actually like, and I miss it being the average
schmo.
Well, not even the average schmo, just, you know, it being generally regarded as not an art form, because then you flew underneath the radar. Mm-hmm. You had this real sense of freedom, that mm-hmm. you had this feeling that, like, anything goes. And, you know, everybody, okay, so everybody thinks you're an idiot. What do I have to lose? No matter what you did, mm-hmm. you could do something sensitive and intelligent if you felt like it.
Right.
And you also could do something completely idiotic. And either way, you just had this feeling that you had absolutely nothing to lose.
Well, that segues into one of the things that I've always found interesting about your work. As a lot of the guys that were in Weirdo, or that you were, you know, contemporaries with, Kaz or Friedman, J.D. King, all these guys were drawing in this whacked out style, but the stories were usually whacked out. They were just fun. They were just comics. They were meant to be funny. But one of the things that I'm really fascinated with your work is, and you touched on it there, you would take this wacky style, this super crazy, you know, Big Daddy Roth, Basil Wolverton style, but then, you know, slam it up against just grim, like the grim horror of every day. Or, right. you know, you had the story of The Reject, or In My Bedroom. These, like, classic comics that would balance on this point of being sensitive or dark, but also being wildly, you know, you have these explosions of, like, just graphic madness.
Right.
And how, I'm curious, is was it just because of that, like, flying under the radar, you felt you could just do whatever you wanted, nobody was watching?
Right. Well, nobody was. Except for the hand, some of the people you just named.
Right.
You know, and eventually other people. But, you know, the following developed over time, obviously. But, what I liked, this is another thing I like, and I like this in almost all forms of art, whether it's music or films, cartoons, and I try to do it in my comics, is I like a weird juxtaposition, an almost ironic or contradictory juxtaposition, where on the surface, like, okay, with comic art or my comics, I like how on the surface it looks wacky and extreme and mm-hmm. dumb. When you first look at it, you think this could be a dumb comic, but then when you read the story, it more often than not delves much deeper than that. It's mm-hmm. much more heartfelt, and I'll be writing about things that, to me, if not at the time I'm writing it, at some point was extremely painful. Writing about things that, when I actually went through it, were horrors. Mm-hmm. I was writing about every single aspect of my life and my friends' lives and of life. But I didn't want to draw them in a way. I never wanted to draw in an art style that would reflect that. You know, something very serious and devoid of. For various reasons, I tend not to like work. To me, it's just very, very dry. I'm not mm-hmm. drawn to it. But it also, it makes it, for me, it makes it digestible. It mm-hmm. makes it enjoyable. So, and it's just laughing at the pain.
Right.
Just laughing about things that mm-hmm. are horrific. Which, it's part of why I, especially back in the 70s, not just me, but a lot of people, I adored Woody Allen. Because mm-hmm. he would be talking about death and his abject fear of it. I'm not as obsessed with death as him, but he would make it funny. Mm-hmm. It would always be hilarious, but what he's talking about, what he's honestly, seriously talking about is depressing, mm-hmm. you know? And he could, He could have worked in this, and I know he was inspired by it, and he tried to imitate him a few times, but he could have worked in the style of Ingmar Bergman, who for the most part, you know, I like Ingmar Bergman's movies, but I really? Don't want to watch them more than once. You know?
I'm surprised to hear
it's
that.
It's not a pleasure. Yeah, no, they're interesting because they're so intense.
Right.
They're so intense and so personal, but I'm not drawn to them, mm-hmm. you know. It's like medicine. Watching that, whereas Woody Allen is candy. Mm-hmm. It's candy that's good for you.
Well, that's the thing that's interesting to look at the subtle shift in your work to the more recent stuff, where you are still have a wacky style. You don't have the explosions I've noticed of,
right.
You know, character just turning into as you described, like grabbing the gear shift, Big Daddy Roth. And,
right.
But the thing that always surprises me in your work is when characters die. I mean, we're in the comics. I mean, Superman dies, he comes back to life.
Right.
But if you could talk a little bit about the consequence, the death that's in your comics, and the irony of this is talking about this morose stuff is that your comics are hilarious. I mean, I laugh out loud every time I reread them. Is this a way for you to process stuff? Do you find it cathartic at all, or?
Well, first of all, for the longest time, you know, I've been my works have been getting published since 1980, and for the longest time, I can't think of one exception where I ever portrayed death or mm-hmm. dealt with death. I never that was a subject that even I was afraid to go near. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to go about it. I didn't know how to incorporate it, and I think the. But then in the last, when Hate had its regular run, when I was doing those color issues of Hate, there was, I had Pops Bradley die of natural causes, and then I had Stinky
yeah.
accidentally shoot himself. And that was, it was strange. It was just sort of tied in to the storyline. It just made sense. And I was still nervous about doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But once I was over that hump, now I have people get killed all the time. And my stories, oddly enough, too, my art style and the way people react, it looks violent. But, you know, when you compare it to superhero comics, right. mainstream comics, my comics weren't violent at all. You know, they occasionally the characters get into slap fests, but I'd make it so slapstick that it looked, and when people get angry, it
right.
looks like there's a lot of violence there, but it really wasn't. My comics are incredibly unviolent.
Well, I'd almost argue that they're more violent in that regard, or there's more of a consequence to the violence than. I mean, I remember as a kid growing up, and what was it? Robin was murdered by the Joker, and I always thought that was retarded. It was ridiculous. It didn't scare me. I never thought for a second that he was dead. But when Stinky, in that issue of Hate, when he shoots himself, I mean, it was devastating. It was not funny. I mean, but now, you know, Hate Annual 7, they go and they're digging up his bones. Spoilers, I guess, but they're digging up his bones. And it's hilarious. But I mean, I know I marvel at that ability to, and the other part too of this, we're kind of getting close to the question
no,
time,
but about
well, one of the things that I, as far as like just the I guess real serious nature of your work, which you then turn into humor. The other thing that I find interesting, especially coming from the comics tradition, or what's become a tradition, like Dan Clowes, J.R. Williams, the Hernandez brothers even, a lot of your comic, and specifically Crumb, a lot of your comics where I like a distinction that was made by Mary Burt for the introduction to Hate Jamboree, where she says that a lot of the comics of that time were critiquing and then avoiding what they were critiquing. They were just
right.
sort of keeping things at a distance.
Right.
Whereas your work really stands out. You critique and you avoid, but then you eventually embrace. And I was wondering.
I have no response to that.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
but
I mean, well, I guess it seems like you're using comedy and humor not only to deal with the shit of life,
right?
But also dealing with a way to accept other people, accept situations,
right?
But I mean, what I think what's unique to the milieu that you're in is that is unique. It's not you don't take like a higher road. I mean, even your title, "Everybody's Stupid Except for Me," and other astute observations. You're attacking, but you're also saying, "Hey, it's me too."
Right. I agree.
That's all you're going to give me. no, I'm just kidding.
Well, there's stuff I could say about that. I don't know if it's answering your question, though.
Well, if you wanted to, you know, just riff on that. I mean, is there a precedent for that? Like, yeah, how'd you get to that?
Well, I had a...
I mean, that seems really rare in comics.
I used to... when I first started doing comics, I knew I wanted to do something creative and something fun. It's not like a fun way to make a living. And I was constantly drawing. To this day, I'm never short of ideas. You know, I hate to draw. That's the problem. But coming up with ideas has never been the problem. Mm-hmm. After a while, especially when I started doing longer stories and I was getting more involved, and I was getting... Like, Robert Crumb, too, was pushing me. It was great advice, but he was always... When I would tell him, I'm a bit nervous about telling this story because it touches on my own life too much. And he says, those are the ones you have to do. You kept pushing me in that direction. Be brave. The thing where you're... Any story you're afraid people are going to make fun of you or look cross-eyed at you, he says, that's the one you have to do. He always described it as jumping into the pool. You know, it might be cold, might be freezing, but there's only one way to find out. You just got to jump in. Mm-hmm. And you might regret it, but otherwise, if the water's fine, then you're having lots of fun. So so I began to do that more and more, and it made me, after a while, I became more conscious of myself and what was driving me to be a creator in the first place. It was something I was never cognizant of, but as the 80s went on and then into the 90s, I became very aware of the fact that I didn't totally understand life, I didn't totally understand people, and I didn't completely understand myself, and I wanted to. And my comics were a way of, my stories were a way of working all that out. Mm-hmm. It was a way of trying to, basically saying, my work was, and it still is, me trying to work out something, mm-hmm. figure out something, and understand some aspect of human behavior. Mm-hmm. While at the same time, and this is, I always know this, I never completely will, because nobody ever has. Mm-hmm. I never completely will have people, or even myself, completely figured out, but that's what I'm always trying to do in my comics. In the strips I do for Reason, I always do that. We'll pick a very specific subject, but as I analyze, sometimes I'll come to a definite conclusion. Sometimes I'll have a conclusion going in, and I'll still have the same conclusion when I'm done with it. But there's been other times where, like, I did a story called Bums, which is about homelessness. I was hoping I could, by researching, and I'm talking about the chronically homeless, you know, not mm-hmm. people who are, like, temporarily unemployed and then have to sleep in their car for 6 months. I mean, the crazy people that you cross the street to avoid. Those guys who are unemployed, who are homeless forever, mm-hmm. you know, the chronically unemployed. And I was hoping, like, I'd be the first one. I was hoping I'd come up with a clear solution to this problem. But then I realized there isn't any. There is no solution. But then what? You know, mm-hmm. no, it's still a problem. So how do you deal with this problem that has no solution? Well, so, I got sidetracked. But that's what... the more... When I became aware of that, mm-hmm. that that's what I was doing with my comics, it almost made me crazy. It made... Because I still wanted to keep going in that direction. But mm-hmm. it made me really antsy as I worked on stories. And it particularly when I was doing those last bunch of... those color issues of hate. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason I wanted to do them in color is I knew the stories were going to get darker, and I was worried the darkness of it would make them less palatable. Mm-hmm. And again, the color literally was candy coating. You know, yeah. I wanted the art to look like candy more than ever. When I was collaborating with Jim Blanchard too, I wanted him to have a more clean, delineated art style. I wanted it to look like some humor comic from
like Harvey comic
from 60s or something like that. Yeah.
There's that contrast.
The contrast there was extremely intense. Mm-hmm. So much so that it seemed to me that even a lot of my peers and longtime readers didn't get it or appreciate it. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get past the candy. They mm-hmm. couldn't get past the color. For some reason, the color drove people crazy with it, but I don't know why. Not the way I colored it, but just the mere fact that it was in color really annoyed many, many people. But I was doing that to sugarcoat the really depressing stuff that I was trying to work out. It had a lot to do with family, my own family, mm-hmm. things like that.
Well, I know this isn't a question, more appreciation I've always enjoyed about your comics is they have that searching quality to them. Whereas a lot of cartoonists, again, they're doing these comics about what they know, like check out my 78 record collection or, you know, this is my opinion about this, you know, screw off, but your stuff, you're always willing to kind of turn the lens back on yourself or trying to really figure out what the hell's going on. And again, I think that's a rare distinction in your field.
I'm amazing that way.
You are. You're a genius. I guess we're getting. I wanted to just open it up for people that have questions here. But before we do that, I wanted to ask what you have coming out. What are you working on now?
I'm starting to do work again for Reason Magazine, but this time it's very different from what I've done before. It used to be for years I would do these 4-page. Journalistic pieces on a specific subject or a specific event, and now what I'm doing is I'm hoping it'll be a series. I just finished up the first one, and so I'm doing these anywhere from 8 to 24 page biographies, and I'm hoping it'll lead to a book. And the biographies they're all about women writers from the early 20th century, but particularly women writers who had a very who led wild lives and had a very... They're women that I relate to, that they had, for lack of a better word, a very libertarian view on life, whether they were self-conscious about that, or that term, or the politics behind it, or it's just simply the way they lived their lives and the way they perceived things themselves. Just had a very independent spirit, and that's how they thought about everything. And what makes them doubly interesting to me, of course, is that they were women. Because we're talking about, you know, before the pill and before, you know, the women's lib. Yeah. And it's striking how, to a large degree, I mean, it's not like they would forget that they were women, but it was interesting how all these women that I want to write about, they all lived their lives completely disregarding the fact that they were women. It was, they never were, they didn't rant and rave about it, they didn't dwell on it, it was just, okay, you know, I'm a woman, but then they go and do whatever the hell they want. And so the first one is about a writer who now is very obscure, but for a long time she was like, her name is Isabel Patterson, and from the 20s to about 1950, she was probably the most influential literary critic in the country. She had a column and would write reviews for the Herald Tribune, and very widely read and very influential and very feared. But she also wrote her own novels. And her most famous book actually is and she wrote it at the height of World War II, which she was completely against. It's like one of the few people that was completely against World War II. And she wrote a book about, it's basically a quick, she goes over events in Western civilization, but just showing how she feels government roles should be, how they help and hinder human progress and freedom. And that's the only book that is still kept in print. She's even had best-selling novels, but a lot of them went out of print. So I want to write about her. I want to write about Zora Neale Hurston. I want to write about Rose Wilder Lane. Those are the three I definitely want to write about. But there's a lot of others I want to write about, too. I stopped reading literature. I stopped reading fiction years ago. I just, when I was, you know, like a college age, I read like a fiend. Mm-hmm. And I completely stopped reading literature, but now I'm fascinated about early 20th century American literature just because of the context. The more you know about history, when you know the context that where this person was writing and what they were talking about, it suddenly becomes much more interesting. So I'm slowly starting to look into that. It takes me forever to read a book, too. Whenever I'm reading a book, if I come across a word I don't know what it means, I have to look it up, and there's a reference I don't know what it means, I have to Google it, so it takes me weeks to get through a book, sometimes months.
Well, that's all going to be in Reason.
Hopefully. Okay. It's weird. I never got there. I kept asking, can I do this? Can I use your pages to do this huge, gigantic project? And they wouldn't give me a yes or a no. So I just started drawing it. I sent in the first installment, and they paid me. So I said, all right, I guess this will work.
I've just been given the 5-minute sign. Oh, anybody who has a right there?
Comment a question. I love the historical strips you've been doing lately, and I hope you'll be collecting those at some point for all the Revolutionary War era stuff.
Oh, right.
In the liner notes to the Rockin' and Poppin' CD, you mentioned that you wanted to do a fanzine about the Spice Girls producer, and I wonder if that was ever going to happen.
Did I actually say that?
Yeah.
you know, it's funny, the people, the songwriters slash producers who worked for the Spice Girls, they're practically owned by Simon Fuller. He has a company called 19 Entertainment or something like that. They do, their big cash cow is American Idol. And so I'm sure they'd make fantastic money or they wouldn't have signed it, but they have like a no talk to journalist clause. I've tried to, back then when I was obsessed with the Spice Girls, I tried to get, especially, there's two guys who operate under the name of Absolute, and now I'm forgetting their names. They have two very similar names, but I really wanted to talk to them because I like their songs the most, and I wasn't allowed to talk to them. So much for that idea. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Just talk about the difference between you're writing a long story for the serial form like Apocalypse Nerd and writing it as a unitary whole like the like Other Lives.
I much prefer doing it serialized, simply for one very simple reason. I like comic books. I don't like graphic novels for me. I like the old floppy format, and I really miss it. I understand, I tried in my own way to keep doing those, any opportunity I can. And that's true to this day. I'm still, when I in my dealings with, for example, Vertigo, DC Vertigo, I'm always talking to them about doing a regular comic series, either writing it and drawing it, or just writing it or just drawing it. But I just want to make comic books. It was their idea to do with Other Lives. It was Vertigo's idea to just do a one standalone graphic novel and not serialize it. And it's for obvious reasons. They don't make money off of the comic books. And they figure that the comic books would hurt sales of the actual book. So they just wanted to put all their eggs in one basket. So, for economic reasons, nobody wants to publish comic books anymore. But I like that, though. I like with Apocalypse Nerd, I like I have more joy into holding in my hand and reading the individual comic books than the final product. Just, I've always thought that was the perfect format. I love the format of comic books. It's just perfect in every way. I could go on and on. And about why I like them, but because of economics, it's ironic how all of a sudden every cartoonist is a novelist now, and it's totally because of distribution and economics, and not because we all wanted to. Although I suppose a lot of people did. I don't know.
One more question. We got right there.
Well, I was wondering, hearing that you don't like to draw, you're constantly having ideas and things. I was wondering if you went back to high school years and you're about to go to college and you're hating your art school experience. Mm-hmm. And knowing what you know now, would you still become a cartoonist or would you do something else?
Oh, really? If I had to start all over again? That's a great question. I don't know. I don't know what I would do if I had to start all over again. That's a good question. I mean, considering that I'd be in the same hometown with the same family and everything, I don't know how I wouldn't wind up becoming a cartoonist again. unless we do take the time machine route, if I could take what I know now and bring myself back, then I'd invest in Intel and Microsoft and not do shit for the rest of my life. That's what I would do. I would buy a whole bunch of old racetrack and go back and bet on all the winning horses.
Well, I think that's it for now.
Do we have to quit? No more time for questions?
Are we having
to poop?
Well, okay, we can do one more.
No more questions.
Okay. Wait, there.
In your marriage, was it hard or fun to have Buddy Bradley date all these women? Did you ever get in trouble with your wife for having him date different types of women in the comic?
Buddy Bradley? You mean get in trouble with my wife?
Yeah, like why?
No. Just right there, I laugh. No. Buddy Bradley was, he's me, but he's also my friends, and a lot of it's just purely made up. So, and the women he dated, they're all include, like Lisa is, he wound up married to Lisa, but Lisa's not based on my wife, thank God. And, but sounds like, there'd be a little bit like based on dates that went on ages ago. I can remember going on dates with girls and finding out I have it's almost mind-boggling how little I had in common with them. Are we from the same planet? And so I would have that happen with Buddy. But But it, almost all of them were based. What I usually do with a lot, all the characters, male and female characters, a lot of them would be, especially an incidental character, they'd be a composite. I'll take two people that have similar tendencies, and I'll kind of meld them, two people that I know in real life, and I'll meld them into one person. And I do that so that there's no one person that could be mad at me. You know, I could always say, no, it's based on him. All right.
Cool. Well, thank you, everybody.